This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The world was shocked over the weekend when Colombians went to the polls on Sunday and voted against a landmark peace deal that was to end 52 years of war and violence, and that took 4 years to work out. The vote was extremely close, with 50.2% against the deal and 49.8% for. Voter turnout was very low at only 37%, which might be attributed to the torrential rains. Colombia is in the midst of a ceasefire for the past month that was meant to mark the beginning of peace and a process for justice. Now the question remains, is the peace deal over or can it be salvaged? My guest is Jennifer McCoy, a distinguished university professor of political science who was the founding director of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. She's a specialist on democratization, mediation, conflict prevention, election processes, and Latin American politics. And I spoke with her last week ahead of the election. Welcome back to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
Okay, this was a horrible disappointment. And I'm sure for people like yourself who are paying close attention, it was absolutely, you know, devastating for Colombians on the ground who've been personally impacted by violence and who voted yes on the deal. I cannot imagine what they're going through. How do you explain what happened? This vote cut was lost by less than 0.5%.
Yes, it was quite surprising, given the polls ahead of time predicted a pretty comfortable margin of victory. I think, though, that it may have been actually those predictions that some people felt like they didn't need to go out to vote. And then, as you mentioned, the effect of the hurricane on the Caribbean coast of Colombia, where it was a very strong yes vote, really reduced turnout there. So the low turnout, I think, had a lot to do with the actual outcome. But it also shows the clear polarization within Colombia about this. I think what it shows is people do want peace. They're not divided on that, but it's the terms of the peace that they're divided on.
Hmm. So do you then feel that poll numbers, being shared quite widely before the election might have played into it? Are we living in an era of too much information? I'm also thinking of the Brexit vote when people sort of were stunned. Those who voted no felt like they were casting a symbolic vote, only to realize that they were casting a real vote because, you know, they kind of, the polls kind of undid the reality.
Well, exactly. I think there are lessons to be learned, certainly, from Brexit, from this, and I'm thinking lessons for the United States coming up November 8th as well, that perhaps the information about, you know, predictions about an outcome may affect, you know, behavior of some citizens to decide whether to go out and vote or not if they think their vote is not going to affect the outcome. I think that's a part of it. It could be that, you know, the polling didn't equally get in all parts of the country. You know, it's probably a number of factors. This was, for the Colombian vote, it was also very fast. In other words, some people, I'm sure, didn't have the time to digest the totality of this agreement that was 297 pages long. So it was quite complex, and, you know, perhaps they didn't really understand all the complexities of it, all the things it would bring, and the repercussions of not voting for it, which is now what we're looking at, you know, is what is next.
Right, and I want to get to that in a bit, but for those people who voted no, nearly half of the 37% of the electorate that showed up, what do you think motivated them? Was it that there were enough things in the deal that sort of upset enough different factions that together their opposition added up?
I think that's probably true. I think the overwhelming concerns for those who voted no had to do with the justice mechanisms, that is, how much accountability would there be for the human rights violations of the FARC, and the fact that they weren't actually going to prison, but they had other forms of justice, of restricted movement, of paying restitution, of community labor. They had restorative justice. But that was one factor. The other was the political participation, and they were guaranteed in the agreement 5 seats in each house of the legislature, the House and the Senate. And some people just couldn't abide by that. There were some other areas of the peace accord, though, that have gotten less attention, and that is, for example, land reform, greater rural development, which was going to take some tax reform to help pay for that. And so there were probably some financial considerations by some involved as well, who may not have wanted higher taxes or a better redistribution of resources within the country. So those who benefited from the past more unequal model may have been unwilling to change that as well. We'll have to look more closely at polling that comes out after to really determine the reason.
Now, Greg Grandin, writing in The Nation, asked, his headline was, "Did Human Rights Watch sabotage Colombia's peace agreement?" Subtitle is, "Like the country's far right, HRW wanted to send human rights violators to prison more than it wanted to end the war." And last week when we spoke, I did bring up Human Rights Watch's opposition to the peace deal. But is that attributing too much to Human Rights Watch?
Well, it probably is attributing too much to a single organization. But that argument was made very strongly by the opposition in Colombia, that these perpetrators, violators of human rights, should go to jail. However, we have to keep in mind that especially former President Uribe, who made this argument against this peace agreement with the FARC guerrillas, had previously negotiated a peace agreement with the right-wing paramilitaries, the armed actors who were more defending the big landowners, and who also, like the FARC, got involved in the drug cartels and protection and extortion and kidnappings, and also had a lot of human rights violations. He made a peace agreement with them 10 years ago that set the precedent for the reduced sentencing, 5 to 8 years. So that's where the precedent comes from. And most of them, many, many of those cases have not made it through the judicial system to have a trial. Or the conclusion of a trial to determine their accountability. So we have to keep in mind that there was a previous process by President Uribe, who was opposed to this current agreement, that had some similarities in the past.
So let's talk about what's next. Now, Juan Manuel Santos, the current president who really did negotiate this deal, has taken the vote seriously in a speech that he gave in Colombia right after the vote. He basically said, you know, we have to respect the fact that people voted no. You know, he said that I have an obligation to basically keep this, to respect the results of the vote. You know, he seemed to want to try to reconcile between the two sides. Interestingly enough, the FARC leader, Timoshenko, made his own statement where he basically said, hey, the peace deal was already signed. And he seemed to think of the vote as simply a stamp of approval without which the deal can continue. I'm guessing Santos is probably righter than Timoshenko.
Well, there's a difference in that this referendum, plebiscite technically, it was called in Colombia, was not legally required to implement the peace agreement.
Okay.
And so Timoshenko is right in that sense. But politically, President Santos felt that it was necessary to gain the public support and legitimacy for the agreement. They each have a point there. And so now the agreement is technically dead to President Santos to implement because of a constitutional court ruling when he asked to hold this plebiscite. They said the plebiscite would be binding, but only on the executive. So that means the result, if it was yes, would be the executive should carry it out. If it was no, the executive could not carry out this agreement. However, they made an exception saying the Congress could carry it out and implement it. So that is still a possibility. The political parties in Congress could vote to approve it and implement it. But that, and Santos does have a majority in the Congress. He could probably do that, even with the opposition. However, again, it gets back to this question of legitimacy and bringing the country together.
And a public mandate, basically.
A public mandate. Mm. And Santos has said he hears the no vote and he wants to try to address it. So he's called for a dialogue among the parties. He's named three delegates, and former President Uribe's party has named three delegates. They will have a dialogue about what tweaks might be needed to be acceptable to the opposition. So we'll see where that goes. And then, of course, will those tweaks be acceptable to the FARC guerrillas?
Right. I mean, and here you have the FARC guerrillas who have basically outed themselves. They've come out publicly. And this deal being voted no on by the public, doesn't it put them in a very awkward position? Are they in a little bit of limbo? Are they even in danger, possibly?
They're certainly in limbo. Right now, while the ceasefire is still in place, which the government has said it will continue, accompanying that is an order to not arrest the FARC guerrillas, because normally during the war they would be subject to arrest if they were captured. And so that is still in place. The question is, how long will that go? And of course, they're in legal limbo and uncertainty. So the real danger at this moment is, if this is not resolved quickly, will FARC members, the troops, the mid-range commanders who are not participating in the negotiations, lose hope, get disheartened, and decide to, you know, stay in the jungle or join the many criminal gangs that are that abound in Colombia, some of whom are those former paramilitaries that I mentioned a little earlier. And so this is the real danger and risk that Colombia faces if it's not resolved very fast.
Right. We're talking about a conflict that goes back over 50 years. And what may ended up having been a difference of a few hundred or a few thousand votes to make up that less than 0.5% in the vote, you know, was all the difference between having this very, you know, well thought out, hard worked upon deal being implemented versus it all sort of being given away. You know, and it wasn't just Colombia, I should add. A lot of other Latin American countries were invested in this. I mean, the talks had been hosted by Cuba at the signing, the very, you know, ceremonial signing ceremony earlier. A lot of different heads of Latin American countries and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry had sort of approved this deal and signed off on it, right? It's bigger than Colombia.
Oh, yes. And the U.S. was planning to give a lot of aid to help to implement. The UN, United Nations, already had the monitors on the ground ready to receive the FARC guerrillas, receive their arms, and help them demobilize. So they're already there on the ground, ready to go. Mm. And so there's a lot in limbo at this moment. But how fast can this be renegotiated? It took 4 years to get this comprehensive agreement. The last year and a half of those 4 years of negotiations had to do with the justice and accountability parts of it. So I don't know how fast they'll be able to find an alternative solution to that.
Hmm. Also, we had talked last week about how this could be a model for other, you know, conflict mediations, for other long-running conflicts to possibly come to an end where there's, you know, fairness and justice, not just peace, but also some form of justice, but not such severe justice that it sets everyone back, a balanced model. And so I'm sure other countries that might have been looking to Colombia are probably scratching their heads and thinking, how can we learn from this? You know, it's sort of sad because we are idealistic about democracy and wanting democracy to work. But when a democratic process like this sort of backfires against the values of fairness and justice, then you're kind of left scratching your head.
That's exactly right. And that's the nature of democracy. It's not predictable. It's not always predictable. It can be messy. And there were other accords. The Guatemalan peace agreements in the 90s required later constitutional reforms, and those were voted down in a democratic referendum. So there are other cases where there have been surprises.
And Jennifer, often electorates can be very much swayed by skewed media coverage. Yes. Was that the case in Colombia at all? We didn't get to talk about that. Was there media coverage that unfairly maligned the peace process and the deal and really kind of misled voters?
Well, I think that maybe what it did more was simplify, because as I said, this was very complex. The justice part of it was very nuanced on the different parts of it and how it would address different parts of the guerrillas. And I think that it was simplified in terms of messages of this is impunity, you know, this is this, there will be no accountability. And so it does require, I think, a stronger and better education campaign to explain to the electorate all of the parts of this agreement.
Well, Jennifer, we're going to have you back on if things change, and depending upon how things turn out over the next few weeks and months, a very tenuous situation in Colombia. I want to thank you for all the work you've done and for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Jennifer McCoy is a distinguished university professor of political science and was founding director of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. She specializes in democratization, mediation, conflict prevention, election processes and observation, and Latin American politics. We had her on the show last week ahead of the election and followed up today after the election. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.